Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Thank you so much for tuning in, and let me give you a little bit of my housekeeping. We are at 7:01, and I don't want to take a lot of time away from the guests that we have this evening. There's so much to talk about and so much happening around in the world. So let me just say that you are on blogtalkradio.com/ S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. The board is just about full, so if you are calling, and excuse that ringing because it will stop in 1 second, if you are calling to call in for the show, then you call in 516-453-6063. Now, if you want to, and those of you who are on the board now early, and I think you all can do it, if you have a question, you press the number 1. Now, I have now something that I want to share with you. At the end of this, I usually have the webinar address on Facebook and usually send the webinar address to my guests. I haven't done that now. We will decide whether we go to webinar or we stay on Facebook, and I'm going to let you all decide whether or not. It takes 30 seconds to set it up, so it's not a big deal. If you get all your questions in and everybody has done what they want, we'll just do Facebook, and you'll see our conversation just between my guests and myself. If not, if we have more conversations, I'll set up the webinar. And with that, let me go to the subject of my lovely guest tonight. Let me just say that I met this woman, we were off the air and we calculated it 3 years ago, almost to the day she performed in a wonderful reading of a play that I directed called Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed, in New York City and at one of the colleges. And that was my introduction to how wonderful Valerie David is as a human being and an artist. But let me just read you some of the things that I'm actually going to read this now. Usually I summarize, but some of it is so special, I think that you will need to hear this. She is a playwright and a performer. She currently performs in her 2 award-winning solo shows. The first is The Pink Hulk, One Woman's Journey to Find the Superhero Within. You know we're going to discuss that. And Baggage from Baghdad, Becoming My Father's Daughter. Now, she wrote that autobiographical comedic drama, The Pink Hulk, to express the empowerment that she felt being able to find humor and superhuman inner strength going through 3 bouts of cancer to become a 3-time cancer survivor. That is something that I just wanted to read verbatimly from her notes. Then we will also talk about Baggage from Baghdad. It is about her father and her family fleeing Iraq in 1941 from religious persecution. And she has performed that all over the world. It has gotten awards. It has been in, I believe, this one, it won the Spoken Word and Theater Award for the Stockholm Fringe and Best Play at the 2022 Broadway World Sweden Regional Awards. She is a published writer. She's a member, and I am, of LPTW, the League of Professional Theater Women. She's a Dramatists Guild member, an Equity member, and a SAG-AFTRA member. So with that little bit that we have about her, I want to introduce you to the most wonderful, sweet human being that I know, Miss Valerie Davis. Hello, Miss Valerie Davis.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me tonight. I'm so grateful and so honored.
Well,
thank
you,
you've
been thanking me forever. It's my pleasure to have you. And as I said before and earlier, this particular program is dedicated to give voice to those people who are not only in this business as performers, but as performers, they are also doing something in the community. But it also reaches out to those people who are behind the lights, behind the camera, who are also doing things and have done things to get in their position. So tonight, what we really want to do is we really want to explore. We've heard so many of the wonderful things that you created yourself to have a voice. So now I want to know how it all started. You see, we see the result of it. Let the audience know from the very beginning. Tell us about your parents and tell us about what inspired the artistry in you. So there you go.
Yes.
Go back.
Sure. Thank you. Well, first of all, I know I was listening to your amazing broadcast with other guests, and it's so impressive and amazing, and I'm really grateful to be on it. And it was interesting, you were speaking with Mamie recently, and you had talked about how your parents were big supporters of you, and I get that from my parents as well. We were very lucky. My mom and dad always encouraged me to be in the arts, and it started from when I was a little kid, and my parents were always in the front row when I was in the Three Little Pigs or I was at a dance recital or a piano recital, and they've always been with me. And I grew up in New York for the first few years of my life, and we moved to Virginia, which was a great place, but luckily we always went back to New York because both sets of grandparents were there. And I remember that my mom and dad, my first Broadway show was Pippin, which is celebrating a big anniversary this year.
Yes,
so
I just live streamed it last night at 54 Below. They were wonderful. They were fabulous. Oh, yes.
Aaron Lee Battle is a friend of mine, and he was part of that.
Yes,
and
he was.
Yes.
Yes, he was lovely. He was lovely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so that was such a huge influence on me and Ivorine. And I recently, last year, they had a special celebration for Stephen Schwartz that I went to, and Ben Vereen was there and all the people from all his shows. And I just loved Pippin, and it really had an indelible mark on me. You know, my favorite song, Corner of the Sky, and just so many of the songs still resonate for me today. And I think that it was something that I absolutely loved. And the other show that also had a huge influence on me was Ain't Misbehavin'.
Mm.
When I was little, and I saw it with the cast of Andre DeShields, and I just fell in love with that show as well. And Nell Carter was on a part of the cast, and those two shows really influenced me to want to become an actress and a singer. And I took dancing lessons and singing lessons, and I haven't stopped since. And my mom said to me when I was little, I would go in front of the TV, and I don't remember this, but she always reminds me and that I looked at the TV, and I was like, help, help, I'm stuck, get me out of the TV. So I was hooked. I still feel that way. And so I think it's always been such a huge part of my life, and the arts have always helped me get through the hardest times of my life, I think, too. And, you know, you had mentioned when I was diagnosed with cancer, every single time I got a diagnosis, I would go to a Broadway show that night. And one show in particular was You Can't Take It With You, when James Earl Jones was in it. And that was just, I always used theater as a way for something to inspire me and to let my mind go to a higher place of happiness and strength from that. And I always thank theater and performing for helping me with that. So I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts after I graduated from college at James Madison University, and stayed in New York and never looked back. So I do love Virginia, and that's my home in New York.
What part of Virginia were you?
Virginia Beach.
Oh, yes. Okay,
I love Virginia Beach.
Yeah, because I lived in Leesburg for a while, but I went to Hampton University,
wow,
which is close to Virginia. Well, people used to
go
there for breaks, you know, down in the Newport News area. I went there for a year and a half. So I do, but I want to, you know, I want to come back to a couple of things. First of all, I do want to shout out to the original Broadway cast of Pippin that I viewed last night,
yeah,
and in the streaming. And they were my friend Candy Brown, who became friends in Los Angeles. I didn't know her in New York, was the original person. What they said last night, which was really interesting, and I don't know if you knew this, that Bob Fosse created the first ever commercial for any Broadway show. Pippin was the first one, and they won the Clio for it. So the thing
I did not know that.
You know,
wow,
the result of that particular 50 years ago, you know, so my friend she's 50 years young. I do want to also say to you that the show Ain't Misbehaving, very close to me, my dear friends Ken Page and Amelia McQueen were in the original cast of that, as well as Charlene Woodard and of course Nell Carter and Andre DeShields. And what a wonderful production it was, and so healing, as you say, when you go to the theater, when there is an illness in your body, when your body is ill at ease, it seems that theater has a way of helping you get rid of that, of taking your mind off of that ill at ease and taking you to another place, if that is to be. So I'm so grateful for you to talk about how theater is a healing source at the same time as an informative one. Now, I don't want to stop your journey. I want to ask you, so you, when you were in Virginia, down to Virginia Beach, when, at what point did you come back up and go to the Academy of Performing Arts?
After college, everyone moved to Northern Virginia in the D.C. area, which was so much fun. Like, all of my friends, like, it was a glorious 4 years. It was, I don't know if you remember the TV series Melrose Place. It was like Melrose Place. We were all a block from each other. Like Dee was one street over. Wendy was the opposite down. Then two streets over was Alice. Like, it was like it was magical, because it felt like we never had that. We graduated from college and had that, oh no, where are we with all our friends? And we're all split up. We basically all moved in the same area in Arlington, Virginia. But what was happening was that when I started working, I just kept having this nagging feeling. And I was just like, you know what? I really want to do the theater. And what the precipice was that I was in a really tough job where my supervisor wasn't exactly the nicest to me. And I remember just being very upset, and I just felt like it was sort of an oil and water situation. And I joined this choir in Northern Virginia, and I started loving going to perform at this choir, and we would be around Northern Virginia. And I remember during rehearsal, I started to cry, because I was like, I love theater and I want to do this. Like, I was like, this is what's bringing me happiness. And then the other thing is that I started auditioning for the local theater in Northern Virginia, and it was the Springfield Players, and they had a production of Zorba, Lenny. I'm like, okay, when in for Zorba. I was like, if I don't get cast in Zorba, that's going to be very sad because I have, you know, olive skin and dark hair, and actually my family's from Iraq, but there's also some Greek in our family as well. So I was like, I'm a shoo-in. Plus, I love grape leaves and souvlaki. So, you know, like, I'm Greek all the way, and feta cheese is my favorite. So I auditioned, and I started, and then I ended up switching to another job, which was wonderful, the American Diabetes Association, as one of the technical writers. And I kept going and performing, and then I was in City of Angels, and all of a sudden I was like, I want to do this. Like, I want to make a go of this, Lenny. Like, I want to be happy in life. And though I love Northern Virginia with my friends, it just wasn't the place that I wanted to be for the rest of my life. And my roots came back, right? I was born on Long Island, and I was like, I want to go back to New York. And I told my parents, and I said, I want to go to acting school. So I started auditioning, and I got into the American Academy, and it was life-changing, and I was so grateful for my parents' support, because it's a big thing to say I'm going to give up a full-time job with benefits to become an artist. And that my mom was, I know it's like not exactly something that they're like, oh, goody, you know, but I think my mom had
easily.
They don't. And they don't. And the funny thing was, I remember my mom, you know, when I went to acting school, I think she really wanted to be an actress. And I remember she started crying. My mother's name is Rhoda. And she started crying one day, and I go, Mom, why are you crying? And she goes, I wanted to be an actress, but my mom said I couldn't because I had asthma. And she started crying. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I think for her, it was something she always wanted to do. And I come, you know, on my dad's side also, I come from a very artistic family in writing and in art and theater. And I had cousins that were actors and one that still is. And I think that it was something I was so grateful for, that they were supportive, though they were worried. I'm not going to, you know, sugarcoat that it is something that they were concerned about as far as surviving in New York, but they knew what was going to make me happy, and that's why I'm so grateful to them as well. And it was a great thing. And then after I graduated, I started performing and auditioning, and there were little hiccups because of the cancer diagnoses, but after they were over and treatment was over, I went right back to acting. And actually, during my second bout with cancer, which was breast cancer, I was still performing while I was under treatment. Mm-hmm. And it didn't stop me. And I was still in this improv group called Cherub Improv. And we would perform at the American Cancer Society Hope Lodge with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And once a month on Mondays, we would go in and perform improv. And this is part of what's in the Pink Hulk. And it was so empowering to perform, even with a scarf on my head and my hair had fallen out, and I still kept going. And it was really helpful, I felt, to the cancer patients to watch someone who was with them. I'm with them. I'm on the journey with them at the same time, knowing that it's not going to stop me and it shouldn't stop anyone else from living their life to the fullest, even with a cancer diagnosis. So I feel not only when I saw the shows when I was diagnosed, but while performing, I think it also helped. And I know this sounds really, you know, pretty out there to say that, but I honestly feel that acting helped save my life and helped me keep going.
I think the attitude of a person when one is faced with a medical challenge, attitude is 80% of it. It's the attitude that you have about it. And I think that that's what you're referring to, is that, you know, you would not give up. You didn't give up on life.
No.
At what point is the Pink Hulk begin to formulate for you? You say that you were still performing the second time you went into bout, your second bout, and then you went into a third. Well, when did the Pink Hulk start to formulate artistically for you?
Yes, that's a great question. It started formulating after my second bout with cancer because there were so many signs of the universe that I was not ignoring. And that's the one thing I feel as artists that we really should always honor our inner voice and our instincts, because we're never wrong, right? If we go against that voice inside, sometimes it gets us in trouble. But when we follow that voice and we say to ourselves, let's listen to that voice, the voice was saying, it's time to write something. And so after my second bout with cancer, the first was with lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I talked to my oncologist and I said, you know, I really feel like I have a story to tell because I survived lymphoma, which is a more universal cancer. And in fact, non-Hodgkin's, it's known that it affects more men in their middle age. And so I felt that with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and then having breast cancer, I cover both men and women. And it doesn't matter what kind of cancer you have. To be honest, you're all in this club together and you all go through the same emotions. And whether it's chemotherapy or radiation or surgery, there's a commonality with every cancer patient, even if it's a different cancer. So I felt that I had two different cancers at two different times in my life. And I felt, wow, this could be something really special. And then this is another support of my parents. I had been working during the second bout with cancer at an ad agency. And after the cancer was over, I said, you know what? I want to quit my job and start writing. So I'd never done this before, but I quit a job with having a job. And it was interesting because the owners of the company were wonderful to me, and the company was wonderful through my treatment. And I remember one of the owners spoke with me my last day, and he said, you know, Valerie, I support your decision because I know you've got something here, and I know that you're going to do something with your life, and we couldn't be happier for you. And I wasn't sure, it was started to formulate, but I think that there were so many signs. Right after that job, I went to a writing retreat at Omega, and it was Writing from the Heart, Jumpstart Your Memoir with Nancy Aroney, and she had said, we were in this writing group and we wrote every day for 5 days, all day, and we would share our stories. And she said to me, you have a story, because I kept writing about the cancer and there was this common thread. So she said, you should write the story. My oncologist said, you should definitely write a story. My job was like, you know, fly, be free. You need to do this for yourself. And then I went on an improv camping trip and we were to tell about ourselves in front of everyone. And I started talking about it because I had just finished treatment a few months, you know, like 3 or 4 months earlier. And Ollie, who still is the head of the People's Improv Theater, said, you have a story in there. So there were all these signs. And I think what happened, and this was part of the Pink Hulk, was that 2 months after I finished treatment the second time, I was in a bike marathon and I wasn't sure that I could do it. And I had just finished 8 months of treatment, including surgery, lumpectomy, a chemotherapy, and radiation. And I wanted to do this bike marathon, but I didn't think I was going to do it. And so I ended up completing the five borough in Manhattan, 40 miles, 2 months after treatment. So that's part of the Pink Hulk story. So all these stories started happening. And then the Pink Hulk name couldn't be, Lenny, a better name. Why the Pink Hulk? Well, the ribbon for breast cancer is pink. So we know Pink Hulk represents breast cancer. But Hulk, the lymphoma ribbon, is the Hulk lime green. So the pink Hulk represents both cancers. And then the anger I had for having cancer a second time fueled me to fight even more, because anger is more powerful than fear. So the pink Hulk, and then the tagline, One Woman's Journey to Find the Superhero Within, was to find that superhero that all of us have inside of each other. And the thing about the pink Hulk that I feel makes it different and special from just a cancer show is that it's about living life on your terms. And it was an inspiration to never give up hope in anything that happens in life. And it's to conquer any of those adversities that come our way, whether we're not happy in a job or we're not happy in a relationship or we're battling another illness. Like, I remember this woman came up to me after one of my shows, and she had MS. And because I simulate that bike marathon in the show, she said to me and started to cry, you know, I didn't think I could ever do a bike marathon, but watching you do this makes me want to bike again. So there are all these really wonderful things that came out of it. And that's where I was a two-time cancer survivor. But then the pink Hulk changed Lenny in 2018. I ended up having to change the story again. I was in Portland, Oregon, and I was doing a run of the Pink Hulk there. And I had had three biopsies before I got there because I had a bad feeling, Lenny, that something was wrong. I was at a writer's retreat working on Baggage from Baghdad, actually, in 2018. And I started getting chest pains while I was at the retreat. And I thought, something's wrong. So I called my oncologist's office and I said, I have cancer again. And they're like, no, you don't. I go, yes, I do. And they're like, well, you're coming in after you come back from your retreat and we'll find out, you know, you'll have your routine test. Well, sure enough, I had had a biopsy. One of them came back. And I knew that but I wasn't sure exactly what was going on, whether it was lymphoma again or breast cancer. And so the day I was opening the show in Portland, Oregon, I was going into a tech rehearsal at 10:15, and I got a call at 1:15 from my oncologist in New York to tell me that I had stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, and it had spread to my bones. So I was like, what do you do, Lenny? What do you do? Well, the show must go on. Well, so I performed that night. And I finished the run. And it was one of the hardest shows I've ever done, but it's not about me. It's about the audience. And so you know, you have a pact with the audience, whether rain or shine, you do your show. And I did the show and I did the run. And then I came back and started treatment. And I kept performing. And the irony with all this is that I was freelancing at an ad agency in between gigs. And I was working on a new metastatic breast cancer drug, 8-month diagnosed. And I thought, wow, this is a really great drug. I don't have metastatic breast cancer, but wow, this seems like a revolutionary drug and a wonderful hope for people. Well, when I was diagnosed 8 months later, I asked the doctor if I could get on this drug. And she said, I have no problem with it. And I said, okay, let's do it. So it was an oral medication. And then I was still performing and I wasn't letting it stop me. And then 5 months later, it was time for another scan, and I was really scared because I didn't know if this drug had worked or if there was any improvement, if it's grown worse. And then I got the greatest news of my life, that the PET scan came back with no evidence of disease. It had worked 100%, and it's still been this way since then. And that was 2019 when I was on, when I had the scans. I was diagnosed again in 2018, 5 months later, on April 1st, 2019, it had worked 100%, and the doctor said that less than 5% of people on this drug have a 100% response, and I did. So grateful, and I feel like performing the show, I had to walk the walk, because I was with cancer again, and so now I have no evidence of disease. So the Pink Hulk changed again, and it was like a whole new ending for the show, because at the end of the Pink Hulk, I was a two-time cancer survivor, and then I added on that I had gotten cancer again, and then now not having it be detectable. So it was a really just such giving people hope, especially cancer patients who have seen the show, who are in treatment. And at the end of the show, I have a pink cape that I run around in now. And this breast cancer patient came up to me named Brenda after the show. And she's like, can I put on your cape? I want your superhero powers. And she ran around the theater with my cape, and we took these great pictures. It was great. And you know, the other thing that I learned, and this is all of us as artists and just life about what people say to you. So when I was diagnosed with breast cancer again, I called up this support group. And I'll never forget this, and this is in the show, and this goes to show you, don't listen to what people tell you, because your story is your story. And so when I was talking with her, I said, you know, I gave her my diagnosis, and she said, well, you know, you only have 3 to 5 years life expectancy. I hate to say you're not going to die of old age. And I was like, what? You know, this is
right
when I'm dying. I was like, are you kidding me? And I have to tell you the PS of the story. And then I told her, you know, I've been close to getting married, but I haven't gotten married yet. And she said, well, I'm sure you'll find someone who will appreciate the time you have left. And I was like, oh my gosh. It was traumatizing. And then she said, Valerie, I said, you know, I got to ask you a question. Are there a lot of people that join your support group? Because obviously I was not going to, because it was like something that wasn't really helpful. So she said, yes, we do have a lot of members, but keep in mind a lot of them have died.
Oh.
And I was like, okay, yeah. Lenny, seriously, I think I cried for 4 days. I was a wreck. And then a year later, I called her. And I said, you know, when you said those things to me, I don't think you should have said that. I said, this is what's happening with me now, where there's no evidence of disease. So I think you ought to be a little careful about what you tell people who are joining your group.
You know,
I
think that there's an insensitivity that happens. People think that they're being helpful, but they are not. Mm-hmm. Being helpful. And one of the things that people will do to people who are diagnosed is that they will project your longevity of life, whereas you will be here and go to their services yourself, because no one knows how long they're going to be here. So
there's a
possibility that you have a date. That doesn't mean that their date is in the next day or minute. So, you know, it's all in the perspective of how it, you know, how it really, how you look at it. But what fascinates me about you is, first of all, that you just are relentless. And I mean that in the best way, because you live every day. And so many of us in the arts as well as outside, we don't live. We exist and think about the ending so much and we waste time not living every moment and missing the opportunities that are given to us to really, as they say, smell the roses, but meet people and experience things that you're so busy occupying yourself with the negative that the positive gets lost. And so you've nurtured that. And now, how did you turn the 1941 escape of your family from Iraq into a piece that we want to talk about? And tell me, why is it entitled, I'm going to get this right because I'm
sure.
Becoming My Father's Daughter.
It's so it's such a great question, and I also can I quote you?
Quote me, and remember
you
said something that you wanted to say tonight on the show.
Yes, and actually, it's a great preface. First of all, you had an interview with Helene, who's a good friend of mine, and you said something that was so poignant, where you said, "I worked with the devil and I survived." And I said to myself, I love that, because the devil was cancer and I survived, and really hit home. And I love that quote. You're like, I worked with the devil and I survived. And so we all have, moments of having to deal with difficulty in life. But the thing is, we have to survive. And what I wanted to announce, which publicly, was that this just happened, and I put it in the bio, but it was so special that I wanted to announce it on your show, is that I just had found out that Baggage from Baghdad, Becoming My Father's Daughter, won the Sweden Regional Broadway World Award for Best Play. And that was such an honor. And the thing is, the thing is, we don't do our art for awards or for getting pats on the back but this is a tribute to my father and my family. And I think that's what makes it really special. It's interesting because in 2006, unbeknownst that I was going to write a show, I wanted to find out about my father and his past. And in 1941, which is interesting, 20 years apart was Greenwood to the day in 1921. Yes. And then the Farhud was 1941. And they were both celebrating their 80th and 100th anniversaries in 2021. It was just there. I just found that fascinating those pieces of history.
You must say what the Farhud was. Tell people.
Yes, I definitely. So the Farhud was an uprising against the Jews of Baghdad by Nazi sympathizers, and it was a brutal murder of over 1,000 Jews over the course of 2 days. And my father and his family fled that night. And the interesting part that people don't know, which is an accepted part of facts, is that we know what Hitler did, and unfortunately, the horrible situation with the Holocaust. But Hitler also had plans to do the same thing, having concentration camps and gas chambers for the Jews in the Middle East. Because at one point, there were over 1 million Jews in the Middle Eastern countries, including Iran and Syria and Iraq and Jordan. And so he didn't get that far, but it was going to happen if it had gone further, because he wanted to exterminate the Jews also in the Middle East. So no one's really heard of this pogrom before. Even Jewish people, it's not a well-known fact that was going on that people knew. And so with the Farhud, my father and his sister and his pregnant mother were evacuated that night. And the irony is that it's still going on today, right? With intolerant prejudice and discrimination. And it's same thing with going on with Ukraine, that people are not allowed to live the way they want to live, and they have to flee and leave with what they could carry. And that's exactly what happened to my family in 1941. Now, they never talked about it because it was so traumatic, and that's one of the themes of baggage from Baghdad, is, and why it's called that, is that it's baggage from Baghdad with the DAD in all caps. So it's the baggage that of my family, and literally and figuratively. And becoming my father's daughter is how they had been, I had learned so much from my dad, and I became so strong because of his strength. And some of the themes about baggage from Baghdad include immigration and refugees and social injustice, generational trauma, which I felt, prejudice, mental health, discrimination, bullying, and the love and loss of family. And so they never wanted us to learn Arabic. They wanted to assimilate. They escaped to India, and then they eventually made their way to the United States and New York. And they left with what they could carry. And I conducted these interviews of my aunt and my father and my cousin Victor. And for instance, my cousin Victor had to become a boxer to defend himself against prejudice because he used to get beat up. My grandfather was beat up. It's a representation of not just Jewish people, but discrimination of all kinds, which is going on in the world right now. And all the prejudice,
absolutely.
Right?
Of, you know, yes.
Sexual orientation,
I just want to pause now because I want to make sure that the audience sees the correlation between, and you know, before I knew all of these details, I think that you all have to understand that this is probably fate that makes this conversation happen, that in 2020, that Valerie David participated in Celeste Bedford Walker's Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed, and that is the 1921 story of Greenwood, Oklahoma, that was destroyed. And the same thing happened where people had to flee. There were hundreds of people who were killed. It was the first domestic violence. It was Americans against Americans, unfortunately. And most Black people did not know about it 10, 12 years ago when Celeste really started researching and talking about it. And the same things that you were talking about, all of those intricate details where people were being prosecuted, it's universal when there is a prosecution, and that we all need, and through the arts, we are learning about this. And that's what's incredible about the arts. And that's why we really must sustain it, because your story must go on. It must be recorded. It must be
right.
told again and again. You must keep doing it over and over again, because it is like so many stories that are not taught in schools, that are not, you know,
yes.
given to us in education, and it's so very important about that. Now, I want, of course, to talk about so many things to you, but I have to tell you that we're down to the last almost 13 minutes.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay, and before
you
say
anything,
I want to give the members, the people who are on the board, the opportunity, if they want to ask you a question, they should press the number one, and then we'll be able to do that. And also, I have decided that this conversation has to be continued in a webinar. So you will have gotten your information to get off of it. And then people who want to join the webinar, if you go to Face, talking about all these similarities of the arts in these pieces, on just click link on Facebook, and if there's any difficulties, just those of you who can text me, and I will correct it if there's any difficulty. Now, what were you going to say? Tell me.
Yes, something so interesting with Greenwood and the Farhud that we know about, Lenny, is that the estimates of the African Americans killed and the Jews that were killed were the numbers were a lot lower than what really happened.
Yes.
And so that's coming out now with Greenwood and the Farhud, that the estimated numbers of people that were killed is a lot higher than what was previously thought about. So it's just so interesting.
Yeah, what people need to know is that Greenwood was a very, very successful black boom town, as they called them back there at that time, that was very independent from any other cultural, you know, exchange there. It was separate. It was purchased by a black man who sold to black people. And those people had great deals of money, and a lot of those people were killed because they had great deals of money. And then after that happened, there was a legislative law that was created that said that after all the bombings, and because dynamite was dropped on it, that they could not rebuild on burned land. So it gave those people not an opportunity to go back and rebuild this until years later when there was some kind of compensation for it. And I don't mean financial compensation. I mean a change in the legislature that allowed it. So all of these things we're learning through the arts. And where would we be?
Right. It was a thriving community, right, with theaters and shops and just a fluent community.
Hospitals, ambulances, they had everything, pool halls, funeral homes, everything independent of themselves. And the culture that we're talking about, you are independent. And what it is is that it is a destruction of a culture that people wanted to do. And people need, without politically making any statement about it, the arts just informs you of it. And without the arts, we would not know so many things. So,
absolutely.
You know,
and I'm so grateful I was part of Greenwood. So I thank you. It was just one of the, and I wrote this recently, I don't know, I'm on Facebook because it came up as a memory because it was the 3 years ago. And I wrote recently, I said it was, and it's true, one of the highlights of my career. It was one of the most meaningful, special, it was incredible. And I learned so much about a part of history that needs to be never forgotten.
As we all will learn from your piece. And now we've got a few minutes. I want you to tell us what you're going to be doing, where you're going to be. So this is not only a performance, and this is what I wanted to also accent. It's not just people telling us, you know, and I'm doing and now I'm showing here. It is an educational piece. How you're contributing to the community. That's why I picked you all so beautifully. Right. So tell us, you know, what is happening with your pieces. Tell us where those of us who have not seen it, where we can see it, if it's being filmed. Tell us a little bit.
Sure. And I think that, you hit it on the nail that it's not just art, but activism.
It is.
Education. So with both shows, I have talk backs after each performance, and I invite people from the community. For the Pink Hulk, it would be oncologists or other cancer survivors and patients, where we give seminars on coping mechanisms and how to be your best patient advocate and talking about advancements. And with Baggage from Baghdad, there's audience talkbacks where I have two filmmakers, Carol Bostry and Adriana Davis, who are pioneers and champions of preserving Iraqi Jewish culture, and I have them as talkback guests and talking about their films. So it's constantly, and I've done this with the Pink Hulk and with Baggage from Baghdad, community engagement activities, having improv workshops and creative writing workshops, and I'm developing a curriculum, a history course on the Middle East, focusing on the specific time frames of World War I and World War II and how it impacted. And I think it's just crucial to keep these going. And that's what I love, is the magic that happens after the shows. And I recently did the show December in Vermont, and there was a couple that came up to me after the show, and a Muslim couple, and the husband had escaped Baghdad in the 2000s, so not that long ago, with his 5-year-old daughter, and fled the country. And it was such a bond that I had with that couple. And it didn't matter that they were Muslim and I was Jewish. Art shows no limitations on people gathering together. It's a community. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what sexual orientation you have or what religion you have or, you know, what color your skin is. It doesn't matter. It is a oneness and a community that is so special. And it was, and I'm still in touch with them. And I felt like it was just this bond of, you know, and he said the same thing, you know, about his father, because becoming my father's daughter, we both talked about how our dads shaped our lives and what amazing influences they were. And my father, and I, you know, my mother, I love her as well. I don't want to slight Rhoda. My family is a wonderful family. And because my father and his family escaped under the worst circumstances of leaving their home and having to start over again, and he had cancer and ended up having metastatic prostate cancer, and he's such a survivor, and unfortunately he did pass, but what he passed on to me was courage and strength. And I feel like my own family, because of what they went through, having to flee Iraq under civil unrest, gave me the strength to fight my cancers. And because my family survived insurmountable obstacles, it was like, well, why can't I, you know, if they did it, I can do it too. And having them as role models. So that's why becoming my father's daughter was a perfect tagline, because I became my father's daughter, this strong kid, that not the emotional, you know, and I was bullied as a kid. He was bullied as a kid. And I think what changed the story is after he passed away last year in March, I had the story centered around how different we were, but then I changed and became stronger. I found, Lenny, a tape from 1998, a cassette tape that I had forgotten that I had it in a drawer tucked in my apartment. And I didn't even remember the interview. And I, believe it or not, I still have a tape recorder, and I popped the tape in, and it was this whole other story, that because I had stories from 2006, but this showed me that we were actually exactly alike. And that's what changed the story this year, because I learned that we weren't different after all. And one of the lines is said, I thought we were so different, but really we weren't. We were the same. And that, well, I am my father's daughter.
It's just an amazing thing when you have that family bond, and you realize that you are a descendant of such wonderful people, that generation of people who had to survive far more than we are being exposed to. Even though the times now are not great, they really made a world for us, and that we have to really work hard to try to make that a better world. And one of the things I believe that does that is allowing that for people to allow the fact to be universally known that the arts is as important as science, as technology, as English, as math, and so that STEM turns into STEAM. And I keep saying that over and over again, whether I speak at Lehigh University, whether I speak, you know, or here, when I talk to actors, when I'm a performer myself, or when I'm directing, it has opened up a world for me. And I wish that people would see the importance of it beyond an advocation. And it is a wonderful advocation. It is a wonderful vocation for people to have. But what also you can give back. You know, like you talk about Mamie last week and all that she is getting back. She's amazing.
Yes.
Performer.
Amazing.
Performer, amazing teacher at this point in time, I have to tell you. I know personally. And her concern as to what she wants to give back to the seniors, what she wants to give back to the community, you know, goes beyond it. Along with the fact that I constantly asked her, don't you want to perform again? Yes, if it's right. You know, it's all in perspective.
Right.
Arts in perspective, and not let it lead us, but let us lead the arts, and so that we can give back to the community and be, you know, respected and acknowledged for it a little bit more. I think that we would find that programs in the schools would not be cut so quickly. that we would not have to
entice
them. You know, I mean, that their children, you know, you had school programs that enhanced your artistry. Their children now,
yes,
that don't know anything about art in school situation, not at all.
No.
You know, and sadness.
No.
It's so sad. I feel a sadness about that. But
I do
now,
too.
You know, we're down to the last couple of minutes, and so I'm going to say now, next week we'll have a surprise. Jermaine Goodson, who was going to be next week, I had made a misstatement and said she was this week, but next week, is really working hard, and it's hard to fit in all of the wonderful things that she's doing. We'll be there. We'll be with us in April. So we're going to have a roundtable of talking about a lot of different things. And one of the things it is for me to talk about is us being active when we belong to all these organizations, these theatrical organizations, not to observe and give awards to people who are doing things, but to be in that category of doing something. Don't look at somebody and reward them. Let people reward you for moving ahead and doing. And that's the active thing that I'd like all the organizations that I'm involved in to do, because we are a part of that. It's not political, just universally serve people and give them what they need. So with that said, if you want to join us on the webinar, we're going to move from here to the webinar. It is on Facebook, the link. If you need a link someplace else, I can't give it to you that way. But those of you who are on Facebook and want to join us, please do it. In the future, I will find another way to give it to you universally. But we're going to continue this conversation just a little bit. I don't want to tire Valerie out, and nor do I want to tire you out. But I want you all, you know, to appreciate all that the arts has to give to all of us. And I'll keep doing this until you all throw me off the air, I guess, and get tired of hearing my voice. So with that, I'm going to say thank you very much for everyone for listening this evening, for joining us, for listening to Valerie
thank
and her wonderful, you know, stories of how you've created this whole atmosphere of teaching through the arts. And thank you for that. And we'll continue.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, yes, because I'd love to talk about the advocacy work as well,
yes,
that
and
I've been doing. So, yes,
yes,
thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. So thank you very much, and we'll see you
thank
on Lenny Gottlieb's Straight No Chaser next week. But also follow us, tune into the webinar, and hear some more of what Valerie has to say. And if you can't do that, look for it on Facebook and on YouTube and on Twitter, because the video will be there and you'll be able to hear our conversation. Talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, cause they don't know how to love you. Far away, you give me fever. When you